Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Stitch Duran, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show. I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bet.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Around the world once again. This is Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson. Pleased to be with you here on this Wednesday night, January 18th, 2017. And that's my little tribute to Eddie Goldman, folks. We open the show with a tribute to the great one himself, Eddie Goldman. We have a great show for you today. Ricardo Lamas is on the program. He just called in. We're going to get to him in just one second. I wanted to interview him for a long time. Followed his career throughout the WEC and now, of course, in the UFC, and is one of the upper echelon top featherweights in the world. And we appreciate him giving us his time. Any time a fighter can muster up any time, we really appreciate that here on Carson's Corner. So big thanks. We're going to get to him in just one second. And also, we may have Eric Prindle calling in. I'm not sure. Bellator Season 5 heavyweight tournament champion and all-around good guy. Eric Prindle out of Arizona. We may be calling in. Hopefully we'll get to him sometime soon if he does call in. But without further ado, let's welcome Ricardo Lamas to the show. Ricardo, it's great to have you on the show this evening. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on. How are you doing?
Good, good. We really appreciate it. Like I said, we've been following your career in the WEC and now, of course, the UFC, and there's a lot to talk about, including a very high-profile call-out by the number two-ranked fighter in the division. But I want to talk about your last fight before that. As usual, you know, when you step into the ring, it's very exciting for the fans to watch. I mean, you weathered some adversity early on against your opponent, Charles Oliveira, but he missed weight by a pretty big margin for that fight. How did you feel when he came in overweight?
I was just kind of afraid that the fight wasn't going to happen. Reed Harris had come up to me. I was waiting to weigh in myself. You know, and now they do the weigh-ins early in the morning. We get to weigh in as early as about 9, 10 o'clock, I think. So you go down there, and it's kind of first come, first serve. So I was waiting for my turn to weigh in. And Reed asked me to step outside and talk, and I knew right away it wasn't going to be good news because they rarely – you know, pull you aside to talk to you. So he pulled me aside and said that Oliveira was not going to make weight and that if he came in more than, I believe it was 5 or 6 pounds over, that the commission wasn't going to let him fight. So I was, that had me worried that I wasn't going to have a fight again since my first fight with BJ was canceled. So that was the only thing that was going through my head. And luckily he came back And he was like, well, he was 9 pounds over, but the commission said that if you agree to it, that they'll let him fight. And I was like, yeah, of course, let's do it. You know, I didn't want to waste an entire training camp. And, you know, my wife was down there with me and a couple of my brothers. So I didn't go all the way out to Mexico to not fight.
Yeah, I mean, you're an aggressive fighter under normal circumstances, but it seems like an opponent coming in over like that would motivate you even more. Was that something that pushed you even harder?
You know, it's something that made kind of I kind of use that as motivation going into the fight. I was telling myself, you know, obviously this guy didn't put in the work, because if he had, he would have made weight. So I felt like I deserved the win. Just for the mere fact that I put in all the work, I came in on weight, and I was professional about it. So I wouldn't say it was a confidence booster, but it was extra motivation for sure.
Yeah, he seems to have trouble making weight, and I feel like he should have tried to bulk up a bit and leave the division a while ago, because it isn't fair to the fighters he defeats when he comes in over. That wasn't a factor when you fought, though, obviously. I mean, you made him pay for missing weight, that's for sure, but it didn't look a bit dicey in the second half of the first round. In that round, you hit a nice throw and some strikes, but he took the fight to the ground and had some submission attempts. How concerned were you when he had your back?
I wasn't too concerned. You know, you have to stay calm in all positions. When you start to freak out is when bad things can happen. So I kept my composure, and you know, my jiu-jitsu coach in Miami, Daniel Valverde, I get to roll with on a daily basis. He's one of the best black belts in the world, and you know, he has me in dangerous positions all the time, so I'm used to it. And that's just, you know, where the training comes in, and you have to trust in your training and your coaches and listen to your corner. And I defended all the right ways and held out till the end, and came back and pulled the win off myself.
You have some of the most underrated submission defense in the game, and definitely in your division, in my opinion. I mean, everyone knows you can submit guys quick, and Oliveira found that out personally the hard way, but you seem to almost be impossible to tap. Can you talk a bit about where that comes from, and what is it that helps you survive situations with submissions that others wouldn't escape from?
Man, I probably have to attribute that to my pure stubbornness, which I get from my father, I think. You know, it's just that refusal to quit. It's something that's been in me since I was a kid. You know, I was the youngest of, six boys, and, you know, I'd get beat up on a daily basis, but I'd keep coming back for more. You know, it's that was just something that was instilled in me as a child.
And are you like that in training, too, relative to other fighters at the top level?
Oh, of course, yeah. You know, in training, when I'm rolling up, I mean, I can't say that I haven't been tapped out while training or whatever. Of course, you know, it happens to everybody. But you have to I am like that when I train, but I'm also taking risks and putting myself in these bad positions so that I can make the mistakes and learn from them. You know, you have to approach practice in a different way than you do a fight. But the stubbornness is definitely still there.
And like I said, he controlled the first round, but when it was your turn to strike, I mean, he had no escape. You finished that choke very quickly, just like we saw against Dennis Bermudez and Cub Swanson. What is it about your choking technique in particular that has guys panicking and looking for a way out, even some of those top-level fighters?
I'm just, you know, very comfortable with them, especially anything from that front headlock position, any head and arm chokes. I feel like I have a very strong squeeze and just know how to apply it the right way. So, you know, I just attribute that to my coaches and the way they taught me the techniques. And, you know, it's just something, you know, you talk to any MMA fighter and they'll have one or two submissions that they're especially good at. So those type of chokes are mine.
And nobody can doubt the heart of Bermudez or Swanson, but when you slapped the choke on, it was over fast, and it was just all technique. Or is there something about your attitude or style specifically that makes those techniques such reliable finishes once they're on?
I just feel like I'm a well-rounded fighter. You know, as far as the Bermudez fight, I had stunned him with some strikes that dropped him to the ground, and then I finished with that guillotine. So I just think it comes from being an all-around complete fighter and, you know, being able to transition from striking to takedowns to submissions very quickly.
You know, we saw your potential for being an exciting finisher in the WEC, which you put on an amazing run of fights there under Reed Harris. You had some great matchups and moments there, but I think you really started to come on your own when you fought in the UFC. And not everyone in WEC had that level of success. I mean, even someone like Uriah Faber, who had a great run in the UFC and did a lot for the company as a title contender and a reliable star, arguably peaked in the WEC when he had his title run. Was that simply part of your natural development and maturation process as a fighter and adult, or is there something about competing in the UFC that made you deliberately take steps to try to raise your game?
No, you know, when I first started fighting the WEC, I literally had 5 or 6 pro fights under my belt. I had been fighting for probably less than 2 years, so I was still very young and immature as a fighter, and I was forced to sink or swim. You know, they threw me in with the lions right out of the gate, and I had to adapt and I had to learn in order to be successful in that organization. And I think you can see the maturity throughout my fights in the WEC and also in the UFC. It's just the natural process of training every day and getting better and seeing a fighter mature. You just got to see me on a big stage very early in my career, as opposed to other fighters who don't get to that big stage until much later in their career.
And your first 4 fights in the UFC really set the tone for what fans could expect from the Bully. I mean, the way you took out Gryce, Swanson, Hayoki, and Koch really put the division on notice. And there was extremely impressive finishes and fights that you had in the UFC there. What was it about that time which had everything working so perfectly for you? I mean, it's hard to find fault with any of those performances.
Yeah, you know, I think coming into the UFC, I decided to go down a weight class. I fought in the lightweight division in the WEC and then kind of had a really long layoff in that transition and decided that if I was going to go down, that this would be the time to diet and go down the right way. So I think the new weight class turned me into, you know, a new fighter. And also towards my tail end of the WEC, I had started cross training at another gym down in Miami. So that helped me out tremendously. Also just the different style that I was learning down there, as well as the styles I was learning up here, I was able to kind of combine them both together and make my own thing out of it. So I think that helped a lot also. And, you know, just like I said, that natural progression of maturing as a fighter and getting better.
Yeah, we saw what a war Gryce had against Bermudez, where they both tore each other apart. But you put Gryce away like nobody else has been able to, and that made it obvious that there was something special, I think, about you and your skill set. And we've seen since then that Gryce is probably one of the toughest and most resilient human beings on earth. I mean, what that man has been through would break the spirit of almost anybody, and I want to give him a shout out and wish him the best with his continuing recovery from that awful car accident that he was in. You're definitely a true warrior, Matt. And like I said already, Ricardo, you're a very, very aggressive fighter, even relative to other people who fought in the cage for money. Is that a personality trait that you've had throughout your life, or did you develop it over time?
You know, I think it's something I developed over time, and maybe something I always had in me. You know, growing up, I was always one of the smallest kids in my grades and my age group, and was constantly kind of having to defend myself against bigger kids who would try and pick on me, but they learned very fast not to, because after the first time they picked on me, I would unleash on them and then they would never bother me again. So I probably have to thank my older brothers for that, because you know, and any beating some little kid can try and throw at me was nothing compared to what my older brothers did. So you know, I think that's where that came from. But other than that, it came from my upbringing too. You know, I remember being a kid and my parents always told us to stick up for ourselves and defend ourselves. And, you know, my dad was one of those guys where, you know, he said if somebody's bothering you or somebody's picking on you, you go fight that person. You know, you don't back down from anybody. So that was definitely part of our upbringing.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. And the idea of being nicknamed the bully, I mean, based on your fighting style, I could sort of see that. But is there any particular story behind how you became known as such?
Yeah, it's actually it comes from my dogs. I own two English Bull Terriers. So any mm-hmm. bulldog breed, they refer to as bullies. So that's actually where the nickname comes from. When I first started fighting, I had my first Bull Terrier, and I would bring him with me everywhere. He'd come to the gym with me to train, and, you know, he was like my little mascot. So that's where the nickname came from.
That's interesting. You know, we've seen you branch out into some funny stuff, too. I mean, back when a lot of people were either trying to get on Conor McGregor's good side or stay out of his way, you made a very funny video where you parried him pretty hard as the delirious Conrad McGillicuddy, which has me laughing just saying it. I mean, is that something you think people don't fully appreciate about your personality? I mean, you have a more entertaining and humorous side than choking people out and head kick KOs.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate that people don't get to see that side of me very often because, you know, comedy and fighting don't necessarily go hand in hand. And when I'm out there, you know, during fight week for a fight, I'm a completely different person than who I am at home, and I'm very serious and concentrated on the fight. So I've been, you know, over the years, I've been trying to open up here and there and let people in on my true personality. But I think everybody will see it in time.
Yeah, I think most people got a kick out of it, although I think it's fair to say that Conor's fans weren't too pleased. They're loyal
no.
and they support their guy. Conor
himself wasn't too pleased with it.
Yeah.
We had a run-in in the elevator at Boston right after I released that video, so he wasn't too happy about it, to say the least.
Now, do you think that it was genuine, like he was just doing that to get attention or genuinely got under his skin?
No, I think it genuinely got under his skin. I mean, if you look at that video, it's literally the stupidest video you could see, but it's everything that he does. You know, it's like this guy gave me so much ammo to make this video because that's how he acts. So he has nobody to blame but himself for that video.
Were you surprised that he reacted that way?
No, not really. I mean, I think I did a good job of making fun of him, and I think anybody would get mad getting made fun of.
Yeah, there's definitely a desire to see a fight between you and him. I think it would be a real war. And we've seen him show a little bit of weakness with aggressive wrestlers in the past, like when short-notice Mendez took it to him and had him in some trouble. I mean, obviously, he's excellent on the feet, a real warrior. The Diaz fights proved that beyond a shadow of a doubt. Conor is as legit as it gets. But Ricardo Lamas, there's no question that a matchup against him would be intriguing, and you'd present a lot of dangers for him. How disappointed were you when that fight didn't happen, when he was active at featherweight, but more actively he hasn't been recently?
You know, I'm not disappointed at all. It's a lot of people chase him for the paycheck or for the money. I wanted to fight him just to fight him. You know, I didn't care about the money. But I honestly don't think he's going to return to featherweight. I think that ship has sailed, and I think he's kind of outgrown the division. So weight-wise, I mean, you know, I don't think he could cut back down. So, you know, that's it. I'm concentrated on whoever else is next in front of me now.
Would you potentially meet him at a different weight, say 155 or somewhere between?
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, he's made himself into such a huge star, and of course the UFC has assisted him in doing so, almost like an offer you can't refuse at this stage. You know, if you're a fighter, you got to fight him at this point. Speaking of great regards, or great rewards rather, we're hearing about these money fights, which you just mentioned, everyone is after regardless of weight division. Is that something which appeals to you, or do you just prefer to fight people that are in your weight class or you know, relative to your ranking?
Well, you know, I think anybody, if offered a huge amount of money to fight somebody, would take it. You know, that's we're in the prize fighting business, so the bigger the prize, the better. But I think it kind of sucks for the contenders that are coming up because it ties up the division, and then guys that should be given a title shot have to wait for months, and then they end up taking another fight, and then, you know, what happens if they lose that fight? They, you know, they lose their entire chance of fighting for the title. So it has its positives and its negatives.
What's your plan of attack for the rest of the featherweight division?
Well, you know, I'd love to fight Frankie next. That's the fight we're trying to get. I know he's coming off of a groin surgery. From what I've read, he said that he's not going to be out very long, and I was looking to fight in the spring, so hopefully he could be healed up by then. And, you know, that's what I'm hoping for next.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you also have somebody like Max Holloway, and you're literally just a fraction of a step behind him on the right when you guys fought. I mean, it's easy to see you making a few changes and having a completely different fight in a rematch. What sort of adjustments do you think are necessary for you to beat someone like Max, who has the toughness and craftiness to survive being finished quickly?
You know, I just kind of felt off that night. I sprained my knee the last week of camp. So the last 2 weeks leading up to the fight, I wasn't able to wrestle. I wasn't able to grapple or roll. I was basically just hitting mitts and doing my cardio to keep my weight down. So when it came to the transitions from the striking to the takedowns, I felt a little off. I wasn't finishing my shots. I was getting in a lot of great shots on them, but just found myself thinking instead of reacting to finish them. And, you know, in the cage, if you think for a second, then you've lost the opportunity. So I think with a healthy training camp, and if I go in 100%, I'd love to have that fight again.
Yeah, he's fighting Jose Aldo, and that's, of course, somebody you fought before in the past. And even though I know you must be disappointed with the way that fight turned out, I think you were the first person to face him in the UFC to make him look human and beatable. He seemed to be slightly ahead during the fight, or at least the first part of the fight, but you came on very strong at the end, and it seemed as if you took a bit of the time loosening up and getting going in there. Can you talk a bit about how that fight played out over the rounds?
Yeah, I was, you know, I think I just felt the pressure of fighting for the title, and I was being a little too precautious and didn't want to make any dumb mistakes. And so I kind of closed down instead of opening up. And, you know, against a guy like Aldo, you really have to push the pace the whole time and get in his face to win that fight. You can't win just sitting back. He's too technical, and he's too good of a fighter for that. So I think a second time around, I've learned from my mistake, and that won't happen again.
Yeah, we saw in his last fight with Frankie Edgar, who takes everyone down. I mean, Frankie Edgar looked overpowered, which usually doesn't happen even against larger opponents. Even though you last fought him, you gave Aldo a much better contest than most. And you know, you and Frankie have a bunch of common opponents. And, of course, he wants to fight you. He said that he would like to fight you, even though, you know, it's up to the UFC matchmakers to decide how that's going to happen. Is that something that motivates you when you have a fighter that comes out who's ranked number two in the division come out and say that he would like to fight you?
Yeah, you know, if anybody comes out and say they want to fight you, you kind of have to take the fight. You know, that's what we're here for. So, but as far as Frankie, I think me and him are the best matchup. He's the best matchup for me, and I'm the best matchup for him right now at this point, especially in the division. We're the two highest ranked guys, and he's the only guy literally in the top five that I haven't fought yet. So, it just makes sense that me and him should book this fight.
Yeah, you had a couple common opponents, like I mentioned. I mean, he beat Cub Swanson. You finished him faster. He fought Aldo, but I think you took it to Aldo more, as we discussed. The only opponent he defeated, you didn't defeat, was Chad Mendes. And I think based on form, you may have fought a better version of Money at that point. Do you agree? I mean, how much do you take from those common opponents and the way the fights played out?
You know, when you start doing that MMA math, it doesn't really add up.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really look at you know, well, this guy beat that guy and I beat this guy, because until you fight that specific person, you don't know what's going to happen. Styles really make fights, and everybody is a different fighter and everybody has their own style. So I don't really compare common opponents. But as far as, you know, my fight with Mendez and his fight with Mendez, both ended very early, and, you know, I got clipped in my fight, Mendez got clipped in his fight with Frankie, so you don't know how the fight would have played out had those things not happened.
How do you see the fight playing out in your mind against Frankie Edgar?
I think it would be a war. You know, Frankie's a guy that doesn't stop. I'm a guy that doesn't stop. I think it'd be a very entertaining fight for all the fans to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely, for one, want to see that. Listen, Ricardo, again, thank you so much for coming on the program. You've shown yourself to be a great fighter, and I think that there's definitely going to be a title fight on the horizon for you. Do you have any social network sites or any sponsors that you want to thank?
Yeah, fans could reach out to me on Instagram and Twitter. Ricardo Lamas MMA is my handle there. Ricardo the Bully Lamas fan page on Facebook. And you know, that's about it, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. Take care, my friend, and good luck in the future.
Thanks a lot. Talk soon.
Take care. All right, that was Ricardo Lamas here on Carson's Corner. Big thanks to him calling from Central Time Zone, I think probably somewhere in Chicago, Illinois, if I'm not mistaken. But, yeah, it's real. There's so many interesting fights in that division. Frankie Edgar versus, as I said, Ricardo, that would be a very, very entertaining fight. Common opponents, and he's absolutely right about MMA math. I mean, how many fights have we seen where – you know, one fighter beats another fighter, and then they fight a common opponent, and then, you know, something totally different or unexpected happens. MMA math certainly does not add up, which is why we love the sport. That's why, one of the reasons why, you know, us MMA fans, guys that have been covering the sport for such a long time, love MMA. Expect the unexpected. There's no question about that. So, again, big thanks to Ricardo. And really appreciate him coming on the show. What do we got? Let's take a brief time out here on Carson's Corner. And then when we come back, maybe I'll discuss UFC Fight Night 103. It's been a while. It's been a few days since we've been on the air, and I'll give my thoughts about BJ Penn and this Yair Rodriguez, who, as I understand it, now is having post-fight surgery. Not surprising there. Very, very impressive. I want to talk about Joe Lauzon and Marcin Held. Very, very bad decision in that fight. And we'll go over some other interesting fights, including Alexei Oleinik. Did you see that submission over Victor Pesta? You know, I know Alexei Oleinik. I never met him, but I was first introduced to Alexei Oleinik in 2008 in the Yama fighting, the Yama pit fighting championship. And that was a show that was put on by Bob Meyerowitz. He had John Peretti that was commentating, even Bruce Beck. I think they brought back Bruce Beck for that. And they had the Yama pit, which was that elevated, I don't remember if it was an octagon or if it was the elevated cage with like the slopes. And it was really kind of cool looking. And Alexei Oleinik, I think he won the tournament, if I'm not mistaken, that night.
There's so many questions we have as we grow. It's hard to find answers to what we don't know. But sometimes there's someone to whom we can turn to teach us life's lessons and help us to learn just what's important and what matters most, much more than our teacher, and we call them coach. Right there to guide us when we need a hand. They reach deep inside us and help us to stand. To lead by example in words and in deeds, and show us the courage we need to succeed. And I stand before you, I'm proud to boast, I'm one of the many who's learned from the coach. To never surrender your hopes or your that you travel, the choices you make, the load that you carry, the chances you take. We raise our glasses and offer this toast to one who will always be known.
I was supposed to sing backup vocals on that song by Tony Luke Jr. there. Known as the Coach. Eddie Goldman actually sung on his last show, No Holds Barred. I haven't heard that yet. I got to hear that. But Eddie apparently had some sort of singing that he did on that show. I want to hear Eddie Goldman sing. The great one, Eddie Goldman, ladies and gentlemen. I made a mistake. I was factually inaccurate, okay, which happens from time to time here when you do an extemporaneous podcast, as I do here. Actually, Alexei Olenek did not win the Yama pit fighting tournament. That was Chris Tuscher. Remember Chris Tuscher? That big heavyweight, bleach blonde hair. He used to train with Brock Lesnar and Eric Paulson, I think, back and he was in Minnesota. We had him on the show, and actually before we had him on, before he was in the UFC, not too long before he was signed to the UFC, he was on the show, like back in 2008 or something like that. And he does the show, and boom, he gets signed. And that's happened to a few different people, and I don't think that's a coincidence, folks. I really don't. I think people, UFC brass, are listening to this podcast and they want to hear these fighters under some sort of questioning from yours truly, my friends. I just want to correct the record there. But Alexei Olenek is doing very, very well in the UFC. He's got one loss. He's got some spectacular finishes, submission finish. It's always good, I think, to see submissions, particularly when it comes to heavyweights, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of submissions in MMA in general anymore. But to see heavyweight fighters lock on submissions, I think it's more exciting for the fans out there. I don't know. That's just maybe my opinion. Maybe I'm not right. Maybe I'm inaccurate. But I know I like to see guys like Stefan Struve, other big heavyweights win by submission. It's pretty exciting. And Alexei Oleinik, he definitely is a submission machine. 39 years old, 38, 39 years old. He's pushing 40 years old. But you know what? He's one of these guys that he has exciting fights, exciting finishes. He's well-rounded. And he defeated, I'm sure, of Krokop with one of those scarf hold chokes, those side headlocks, you know, where it's not really a neck crank. It's more of a choke where you feel fine, that all of a sudden you don't feel your breath anymore. And he also defeated another UFC heavyweight, although Krokop is no longer in the UFC. He defeated, I think it was Walt Harris, with that same choke. No, it wasn't Walt Harris. It was somebody else, some other UFC heavyweight with that same choke. So the guy knows a bunch of submissions. He's a decent striker, and who knows? You know, he could challenge for the heavyweight belt, which is owned right now, of course, by Stipe Miocic. Stipe Miocic, who's disappointed that he earned less money than Alistair Overeem. Stipe earned $600,000, and Alistair earned $800,000. I'm sorry, I'm being momentarily distracted here. It was Anthony Hamilton that Alexei Oleinik got that submission over. But in any event, the heavyweight division is completely wide open. I think, you know, the instability with Kane being injured, Kane most likely not fighting again. I can't imagine Kane fighting again. You have the potential Verdum rematch against Stipe Miocic, the champion, of course. But there just doesn't seem like a lot of heavyweights. It doesn't seem like a real vibrant division. Of course, you've got this Francis Ngannou that's fighting Arlovsky coming up very, very soon. He's a promising, relatively young heavyweight at 30 years old. People are excited to see him. You've got a number of European heavyweight fighters out there. Daniel Emelianchuk, I can't pronounce that last name, but you'll have to forgive me there. And you know, other fighters out there. But we'll have to see what happens when it comes to the UFC heavyweight roster. All right, on to UFC 103. This was in Arizona at the Talking Stick Arena in Phoenix, Arizona. Really sad to see Mike Goldberg have to purchase a ticket for that. Did you see that? I felt bad for the guy. Mike Goldberg having to buy a ticket and have to see this event from the cheap seats. You know, I want to find out more about this. Is anybody else curious about this? Is anybody else curious as to what happened, why the UFC is shunning Mike Goldberg? And I'm not saying that Mike Goldberg didn't do something. I'm not saying that there's not something that happened behind the scenes here. I mean, I've heard a lot of different rumors, none of which are too flattering to Mike Goldberg. But I want to find out, you know, because Goldberg has been with the UFC since 1997, I believe. He gets a lot of flack from these guys that are overly concerned with the technical aspect of broadcasting. They forget what Jerry Millen said, and I agree with Jerry Millen, that these fighters or these announcers are wallpaper. They should be wallpaper. You should be fixated, focused on the fights. Nobody buys a pay-per-view to hear the announcers. It doesn't matter, you know. And so Joe Rogan announces the fight from a fan's perspective. It's like a fan. It's like, you know, you and your buddies in the living room, and you see somebody get hit. You go, oh, Sure. And it's great. Nobody wants Rogan to be replaced. Is Rogan technically the best broadcaster? Probably not. You know, Rogan doesn't have that good of a broadcast voice. He's knowledgeable. He knows jiu-jitsu. He's a black belt, whatever degree black belt. I don't know. He's been training in martial arts. Okay. He's been around the sport. We concede that he's credible, and he's good, and he fits the product that the UFC wants. He's accepted by this young demographic that the UFC wants to deliver their product to, and that's fine. Okay, that's great. But Mike Goldberg, on the other hand, was just fine. I never had a problem with Mike Goldberg. I enjoyed his commentary. I always thought that he you know, perhaps wasn't a perfect broadcaster, but I don't watch these fights from a broadcasting standpoint. Only the clowns in the media do that. Only these armchair quarterbacks watch from a technical. His commentary is not correct, and it's come on. His play-by-play, Rogan is having to take over for him and do the play-by-play. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. Okay? So I want to find out what's going on with Mike Goldberg. All that it's going to take. You notice he's been very quiet since he's been released from the UFC. He's been very, very quiet. He hasn't done any interviews because I'm guessing if he starts to do interviews, if he starts to really, really open up, that he's going to wind up getting Dana White upset, getting Dana enraged. And then Dana White, who we say controls the media, has a hegemony over the media, no question about that, is going to start opening his mouth. And then, you know, Mike Goldberg is going to be besieged by the UFC sycophants, okay? And so maybe Mike Goldberg doesn't want that. There's also, you know, an interesting, analysis on why Mike Goldberg's son went to Twitter and started to complain about it, you know, complain about his father not being appreciated by the UFC. So if you have Mike Goldberg's father or Mike Goldberg's son going to Twitter and complaining about the UFC, then maybe he was screwed over. I mean, if his father or if his son thought that his father was at fault, his father was a screw up, his father was this and that, you know, why would he go to Twitter and say that his son or his father was screwed by the UFC? All of this is just, you know, there's a lot of unanswered questions, and I want to find out about it. I really do, because I think the UFC owes, from what I can tell, the UFC owes Mike Goldberg more gratitude than they're giving him. Certainly, this man had to buy a ticket. It's a disgrace. That's disgusting. It really is. But then again, the UFC, under new management, they're not even allowing fighters to have any tickets. They're limiting the amount of tickets that fighters can get for the events. It's really, really unbelievable. Okay, we've got UFC 103. I want to give my thoughts on the fights that I saw before we move on here and talk about other issues. And, you know, there's some fights that I thought were noteworthy and kind of stuck out. You had this Devin Powell and Dracar Close. I was commenting on Facebook that Devin Powell didn't seem to have the skill level to really be in the UFC. And I'm sorry to say that. I'm not trying to be insulting there. You know, Dana White, he's on this show that he does looking for a fight with Matt Serra and somebody else. And they go to these – I had never seen a single show, and I don't have a television, and I really don't desire to see a show. I don't want to see Dana. I don't want to see the star, okay? I don't want to see – I really don't. But, yeah, he goes to these local MMA events, and he seeks fighters, and he signs them to a contract. And that sounds great and everything. You know, there's plenty of MMA events out there, smaller shows, amateur shows, I mean professional shows, even in Freehold. You know, can you believe in Freehold Township, where I grew up, now they have MMA shows at the iPlay America there. It's really amazing. I was slobbing down Burger King one day, and I look on the banner, and all of a sudden they see MMA, and it's really, they attract a lot of people there. The parking lot's full. You can't get in anywhere at the iPlay when they have these amateur MMA events there, and you've got a lot of the local schools there, or a lot of the Gracie-affiliated schools that are, you know, Tiger, all the different big name schools that you'd recognize are sending fighters to iPlay and all across America to fight in these local amateur shows. And so Dana White, I think he wants to validate this show and wants to, you know, make it so these guys can fight on the UFC stage. But, you know, just because a guy is 8-0, whatever, in a local promotion, it doesn't make him ready for the UFC. And you look at, you know, there are different promotions out there that you could fight, and you could say, okay, that if this guy fights in Legacy, or if this guy fights in maybe Gladiator Challenge, I mean, there are some fighters in Gladiator Challenge that could compete in the UFC, or King of the Cage. Those are, you know, your upper echelon, mid-tier MMA promotions out there. Then they may be able to go into the UFC, you know, but this guy, Devin Powell, I don't think he has really any ability to advance in the UFC. And that's not to say that he can't. That's not to say that he can't get better, that he can't improve. He's still a young guy. But I don't see it. I don't see it. Now, it should be noted here that this guy, Devin Powell, actually fought in the World Series of Fighting. So that's a bigger, a major MMA promotion out there. But that's the only fight that he's fought in, you know, a mid-size MMA promotion out there. So, but his opponent, on the other hand, Dracar Close, did look like he belonged out there, looked like a powerhouse, and looked like, you know, he could really potentially advance in the division. Now, another fight that I saw and I thought was pretty interesting, I knew it was going to be a boring fight, but a fighter that I'm partial to is Ben Saunders. Now, Ben Saunders has been in communication with our producer, Donnie Riley, about appearing on the show, and I think it's only a matter of time before we get him on the show. He's got his ear to the ground when it comes to the forum. He thanked the forum, which is great. I love when fighters thank the underground forum. And unfortunately, thanks Sherdog, which is bad. But you know, he's a down to earth guy. He reads the forums. He's online. He's got his finger on the pulse, you know. And he fought Court McGee, who you know, I think came off of a layoff. And I knew it wasn't going to be that exciting of a fight, but nonetheless, he did what he did. He won, and a win is a win in the UFC. And so, you know, he's, you know, in the position, if he wins a couple more fights, who knows what could happen. He could be a late replacement in that division. He could, there's, the sky is the limit for still a relatively young Ben Saunders. And I thought he did a really, really good job. I don't think it was a controversial decision. I think the kicks that he landed during that fight were devastating. Not devastating, but they definitely took their toll on Court McGee, and that's Ben's style. And Court didn't have really any type of aggression during the fight. I mean, he didn't attempt to take it to the ground, as best as I can remember. He sort of was just content to exchange strikes with Ben Saunders, who you have to give the advantage to in striking. And I don't think it would have been possible for Court McGee to, you know, decision Ben Saunders, because in most of his fights and most of his wins come from decision. That's fine. I mean, you know, the UFC may not be happy about that. They would probably want more submissions, more knockouts, more fight finishes. But a win is a win. You know, that's the way it is. And so It just was an uphill battle the way he fought, and just it was a tough matchup for the Crusher, who actually used to train with Court McGee as well. That was a fight that stuck out, and another fight that stuck out to me was, of course, the Joe Lauzon Marcin Held fight. And we used to call him Joe Luzon because him and I, he used to go at me on the forum all the time. I remember years ago, he used to just absolutely berate me on the forum. And that's fine. I was a troll. We were a troll show back in the day. And Joe Luzon is generally liked by everybody. And it was very, very classy what he did after his fight, acknowledging that he lost the fight. I don't recall ever seeing a fighter do that. Have you? Have you ever seen a fighter admit that they lost a fight even though they won a decision? And then afterwards, he said that, you know, winning a fight that you really lost is worse than losing a fight that you really won. A big show of respect and show of humility on the part of Joe Luzon, you know, fighting the much heralded Marcin Held, who was coming off that loss against Diego Sanchez and, you know, didn't look all that good in this fight, but I thought he won the fight as well, okay? And I was really surprised by this decision, and a lot of people were disappointed by the officiating in Arizona, which is kind of surprising because Arizona is not really a stranger to mixed martial arts. You have MMA, like I said, Rage in a Cage, King of the Cage fighting in there. You probably have other promotions that exist, but it's boxing judges that are responsible for these bad decisions. And I don't want to say it's an epidemic, but certainly the judging criteria could be strengthened. And then, of course, you had the main event, Yair Rodriguez versus BJ Penn. And this was a fight. This was the equivalent of an old veteran. And I emphasize old because, God, did BJ Penn look old in there. Putting over the young new star of Yair Rodriguez, you know, basically acting like a punching bag for him and really showcased the skills of Yair Rodriguez and solidified him. And said, you know what, you know, this kid really is for real. His striking was dynamic. And, you know, that's what you're seeing now, I think, in a lot of divisions, in many divisions. It's the strikers like Conor McGregor and like Cody Garbrandt. Cody Garbrandt's 135. And then Demetrius Johnson's everything. But, you know, you can go to 170, and then Tyron Woodley. Tyron Woodley's kind of striker and grappler, but previously it was Robbie Lawler that held the belt, you know, for several defenses. And then, you know, 185, you've got Michael Bisping, who's a striker. 205, Daniel Cormier. For the most part, it's strikers. It's strikers, people that can stave off the takedown, fighters that can stave off the takedown, and be successful. And, you know, impose their will on their opponent. And I think Yair Rodriguez really showed that. He really showed that his mix of striking, his unpredictability, his versatility is going to be difficult for anyone in that division, you know, because I wasn't sold on him. I based on what I saw, I just... You know, the featherweight division is a stacked division. We just had Ricardo Lamas on the program. There are just a lot of people, a lot of fighters in that division, and it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to really, really make your mark. But now, you know, he beats BJ Penn. He hasn't lost a fight this year, Rodriguez, since, what, 2012? Okay, he's won. He hasn't lost in the UFC. So you got to think that he's probably, for whatever the UFC rankings are worth, he's definitely moved up. No question about it. And so, but he definitely was put over this fight. He definitely appears to really, really be someone that has a bright future at 25 years old and a nice, humble person, a good kid that trains at the MMA lab, trains with, I believe, Crazy Pena. Angry Pena, who some people on Facebook are getting annoyed that I'm using that. I don't care. I find it so funny. I really find that name funny, and I think that we should all attach to her because she's becoming more and more erratic as the days go by. It's really, really dissolving into mental illness here, drifting not so subtly into mental illness like some other people I know. But Yair Rodriguez, you know, this is a kid that it's going to be exciting to see him fight in the future, and the world is at his disposal at this point. We have to see what's going to happen. I haven't been able to confirm. I believe he was suspended after this fight based on, I think, some sort of a medical reason. He was suspended by the Arizona Boxing and MMA Commission out there. And, you know, he probably had an injury that he had to address, or he certainly didn't sustain any punishment in this fight. So we're going to take a brief time out. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about the world of MMA. We'll also take your phone calls at 347-326. That is 347-326-9749, folks. We'll take your phone calls as we come back. What song do I want to play here? I have a whole studio full of songs here, mainly consisting of Rage Against the Machine songs. All right, let's play this song here. It's a great song. Ladies and gentlemen, Kumite. I am actually a personal friend of the Kumite champion, Frank Dukes, ladies and gentlemen. Frank Dukes is a personal friend of mine, inspiration for the movie Bloodsport. He actually wrote some of the movie, and what was the other movie he did? There's a bunch of movies Frank did. Legend. An absolute legend. Frank Dukes is a good man. Frank Dukes is an altruistic man. Let me tell you something. And this is true. We're working on getting newspaper columns here, okay? Carson's Corner, we're working on becoming contributors to not national newspapers, but newspapers that my political show and my MMA show, we're going to be writing. I'm not the best of writers, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I'm okay. I'm a postgraduate student. You know, I can write a paper, but I'm writing. I guess I'm all right. I mean, I'm not really I don't consider myself a good writer, you know. But you know, if I spent the time, I could probably write out a decent article. Wrote an article about Andy Wang and Herb Dean on the program. How, you know, Herb Dean is helping Andy Wang. You heard about that on New Year's Eve when we had Andy Wang on the program. And, you know, I've written articles in the past. I've written for some websites, and it's not something that it's very time consuming. I'd rather just do a podcast because it's easier for me to do a podcast than it is to sit down and write, you know, even a 500 word article or a 1,000 word article. You know, it's just painstaking, but whatever. If we could spread the word, if we can, you know, reach new people, that's great, because MMA needs to be covered, and it needs to be covered from a perspective that is not offered, that is not interfered with by the UFC, by the hegemony that Dana White has and the UFC has over the media, this constant interplay, the duress, the submission that takes place from these so-called MMA sites to the UFC is just disgusting, folks. It really is. By the way, I want to give another shout out to Ricardo Lamas, who said it's okay. He's agreed to appear on the show, and it's okay if I contact for further interviews. I want to thank you, because you know why? Because that's not the case with some of these guys. I'm telling you. Some of these fighters, you know, for whatever reason, I can't get them on the show. And I'm one of these guys that I always look for new blood when I'm interviewing people. We've had reoccurring guests on the program in the past, but I don't like to really bother somebody, like, or not bother, but I don't like to do it. Like, I have, you know, people that I've had on before, but for some reason I'd rather just interview new people if I can, for the most part, if I had any control over it. I just feel that once I've interviewed somebody, it's almost like, okay, you know, we've explored that, we've explored, you've sat down, you've answered my questions, you know, we've given the audience a perspective that they're not going to have, or information that they're not going to have listening to, you know, the other short-term podcasts that the short-term podcasts that talk about only what's in the now, they're not concerned about. I mean, when was the last time you think Ricardo Lamas was asked about, you know, WEC or his career or whatnot? You know, even someone like Luke Thomas. If you ever listen to someone like Luke Thomas, who, you know, again, I've said is a smart guy, and I do listen to SiriusXM because that's what I do. I drive in my car. I got to tell you, I'm so pathetic. But if you listen to his interviews, you could tell there's no preparation for his interviews. And you could tell, like, some of these questions are just, like, so stupid. Like, really? Is it hot out there? What's it like out there? You know, just these real kind of off the cuff and just off the top of his head questions that are, yeah, I mean, come on. Give me a break. You're not going to learn anything. Historians are not going to look to the Luke Thomas show to get information about somebody's career. You know, we were cited in the book one time. This show was cited in I think, Jonathan Snowden's book about the MMA, the Encyclopedia of MMA. But, I mean, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe they would cite his program because, you know, everything is so it's so shallow nowadays. But, you know, I was going to say, I'm so pathetic now. Like, I just drive in my car my days off, and, you know, if I'm not doing schoolwork or whatever, I'll drive in my car, you know, for like 4 or 5 hours, just listen to the radio, and I'm just really bored a lot of times. And I'm starting to go to diners now. I'm very proud of myself because I haven't had any soda in like 5 days, and soda's killing me. I figured out that, you know, I can eat what I want to eat because I love food. All right. I mean, you know, anybody that's been following my show knows that I've struggled with weight for years, but I can eat, you know, basically what I want to eat. But if I drink a liter of soda, or sometimes 2 liters of soda, if I do that every day, I'm gonna wind up fucking dead. You know, I'm gonna wind up whatever, high blood sugar, you know, fill in the blank. And so I stopped drinking soda because and in the past I've stopped to drink soda. I haven't drank soda. And in the last like 5 days, I haven't had to go to the bathroom every 2 seconds. So I feel like I have a new bill of health. But I go to these diners now, and I go to like all these diners, and I'm just like eating in my car. You know, you go to a diner with like a girlfriend, and you go there, you get a table, you have a nice talk or whatever. There's a jukebox, and you play the jukebox, and you instead of doing that, I get the food from the diner, and I just eat in my car. And it's so pathetic. But I it's like I'm just trying to stay away from fast food because I just don't want to kill myself. And you know, I'll have like a chicken salad or chicken wrap, which is great. Some of these diners make great food, and I'll just eat it in my car. That's it, man. And I'll just dispose of it and get the hell out of there. You know, do what I got to do and whatnot. You know, that's what I got going on now. All right, what are we talking about here? I was talking about fighters that don't appear on the show or only appear once, and then I can't get them back. And I think some of these guys are just, I don't know if they get disappointed after they come on the show. Maybe they don't like the questions, or maybe the length of the interview is something they're not used to, or I don't know. Maybe that somebody just told them stay away from that guy. Maybe it could be any number of different reasons. It could be that maybe they're just not available on that day, or you know, I don't know. Who knows? But usually when I get a fighter that will text me after the interview and agree for me to contact him, that's a good sign. So I feel pretty confident in saying that we'll have Ricardo Lamas on the program in the future. As he starts to really, really hone in on a title shot. One guy I may reach out to is Tim Boach. I may try to get him on the program. He's fighting this Jacare. That's going to be at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, okay? And people are really almost disappointed at this fight. I mean, what is Tim Boach? He's ranked 14th. Or something like that. I don't know if you can really take stock in the UFC ranking system, but he's certainly not a guy that's anywhere near, you know, Jacare, who really is supposed to have a title fight. You know, nobody wants to fight Jacare, and I can understand that. So I want to try to get Tim Boach on the program. Yeah, this is going to be at UFC 208 with the women's a featherweight championship on the line versus Holly Holm and Jermaine Durandamy. And I got to tell you, I didn't know this, but Amanda actually beat Jermaine, and she beat her pretty convincingly. I mean, although the elbows were, I think they weren't landing. I think it was a bit of a questionable stoppage, but Jermaine is not a world beater. You know, they're building her as this, they're focusing more on her Muay Thai record, and they're not really paying attention to her career as an MMA fighter. And she's coming, or she's fighting against Holly, who is coming off of 2 losses. So it's very conceivable that Holly wins, and then boom, Holly fights Amanda. Now, let me tell you something about Amanda. I saw another Amanda interview today, and I think the UFC is a problem here. I really do. And I may get a lot of flack for this, but I'm telling you, the UFC, they cannot be happy with Amanda Nunes as their champion. It's not that Amanda isn't a good fighter. She's a very good fighter. It's not that she can't, you know, provide highlight reel knockouts. It's just that she doesn't have that it factor. She doesn't have the personality I don't think she's ever going to be a draw like Ronda Rousey is, because I listened to an interview from her today, and it was horrendous. Now, I know that, you know, she obviously English is not her native language, and she's trying, and you got to give her credit. I mean, there are, you know, female fighters and fighters in general. Like, look at Khabib. Khabib learned English, you know, that are trying, and they realize that this is sort of drifting towards the entertainment side of things. But I'm telling you, Ronda Rousey can come back and fight Sarah McMahon, which I think would be a very good opponent for Ronda. She could fight Sarah McMahon, and that she would get more pay-per-view buys despite her embarrassing two losses than Amanda Nunes would get versus anybody. I mean, really. I mean, come on. Let's be honest here. And so, you know, they're kind of, I think, they don't have the stars anymore with a lot of their champions. You know, the company at this point in terms of pay-per-view buys is resting really on Conor McGregor. And, you know, there's still a shadow of a doubt about Ronda Rousey. Although, you know, Ronda Rousey comes back and I don't think she's going to be able to get over 1 million pay-per-view buys. I don't think she's going to be able to get anywhere near that, you know, with the way that she's lost the last two times. But I have to be honest here. I don't think that Amanda is really, really going to be very, very, I guess, a big draw for women's MMA. Now, there is the possibility you could have one fight, and there is a possibility of Cyborg coming back. I mean, who knows what's going to happen with her, you know, with the latest flagging for U.S. Anti-doping by USADA. I forget what the diuretic was, but her camp did not apply for a therapeutic exemption. She took the diuretic, and now she's, you know, flagged again. And so how long is she going to be suspended for? You know, what is her problem? She's not going to be fighting for at least another, I would say probably another year or so, okay? And Cyborg has problems. Cyborg has reservations. And can anybody in their right mind say that if a fight between Cyborg and Amanda took place, that Cyborg and Amanda would agree on the weight? Like, they would disagree over every single detail, that the fight is probably less likely to happen than it's likely to happen. So what I'm saying is that that the division is completely uncertain, and the health of women's MMA is not good at this point. I mean, if you look at the long-term you know, picture, it's really not. And so I want to see what's going to happen here, but you know, it without Ronda and having Amanda the champion, I mean, could you imagine if Ronda was still the champion? You know, could you imagine if Ronda, you know, had beaten, you know, Holly and had beaten Amanda? I mean, God, she'd be getting, the pay-per-view buys would be, you know, substantially increasing, but that's not the case. She was exposed in one aspect of her game. And so the UFC, you know, they may have bitten off more than they can chew here, now establishing another division, a featherweight division. Yes, you've got Invicta. Yes, you've got, there are actually a lot of, not a lot, but there's a decent amount of prospects out there. If you go pick up your latest Fighters Only magazine, you'll see that there are female fighters out there. There's Mackenzie Dern. There's Angela Lee. And she's, I think, an atomweight. And Mackenzie is listed at 115. You've got, I mean, there are other, you know, female fighters out there. There's this one that just fought Invicta that beat Sajara Eubanks. I forget her name. Undefeated. Yeah, I get it. I'm not saying that there's no female fighters out there, but really, is there a lot of them? Is there a lot of female fighters to even establish a 125 division? You know, it doesn't look like it. And you've got Megan Anderson that won, not surprisingly, against Charmaine Tweet, And, you know, she wants the winner of – so, you know, there's different fights to play with. But, again, as I said, if you look at the long-term picture, it doesn't look good for women's MMA. And I don't know if you're going to have a lot of women that want to do this. You know, a lot of women that want to go through getting punched and kicked and whatever for a measly $10,000. I mean, it's just – it's absurd. One woman that is willing to do it, and I was surprised about this because I didn't know about this, is this Heather Hardy. I don't know if you guys have been following her. She's a boxing champion, undefeated boxer. And I'm following her on Instagram, and I actually knew of her through SiriusXM. She appeared on that Randy Gordon and Jerry Cooney show. Eddie Goldman was basically banned from that show. I mean, before Jerry took over as the co-host, you know, going back to what I was saying last week, she was supposed to fight an Invicta, and her opponent actually, I couldn't make the fight. I don't know if it was a weight issue or whatnot, but I was actually pretty interested in that because Heather's a very, very good striker. A very, very good boxer, and she could definitely make her mark in Invicta, but she has limited grappling. She's training up at the Henzo Gracie's, I think, in Manhattan, but it's an interesting foray into MMA. And you know, but Heather has got to be 30 years old. She's, you know, she's not like a 25-year-old or even younger. You also got Kayla Harrison, who I don't know how much she weighs, but you know, she's probably up there in weight. You know, she's not, I think, probably maybe a featherweight, maybe above that. Okay, she's with the World Series of Fighting, basically a brand ambassador at this point. So you got a lot of things going on. You know, there's some potential out there, but again, I have to be honest. I don't see a bright future at this point for women's MMA. I really don't. And MMA as a whole, because we're in a different era now, folks. I mean, this is completely different now. You know, this is not the Fertittas. This is not Zuffa. This is not the Zuffa machine anymore. This is WMEIMG. Okay, they're a talent agency, and they have different investors that they have to appease. And we know what happens when, you know, these corporations take over companies. You know, we know what happens to the workers, to the employees. It doesn't look good. And now you've got, you know, different financial pressures, and you've got the UFC and their television deal up for renewal. You've got, as I said, a declining number of pay-per-view stars out there. I saw one report that says that the UFC, I think I mentioned this last week, that I think it was in the last year that the UFC had 5 or 6 pay-per-views that did over 1 million buys, okay? 5 or 6 pay-per-views that did over 1 million buys. Now, this year, 2017, we're already almost in February now, they don't have any championship fights booked. I mean, yes, you've got this the new division, the featherweight women's fight. You've got supposedly an interim title in Holloway versus Aldo, and you've also got Khabib and Tony fighting. But really, that's it. I mean, what other fights are there? Daniel Cormier is injured. He should be fighting April. May Gustafson, you know, he's always injured. You've got, you know, as I said, the heavyweight division. What's next for Stipe? I don't know. You know, is that on solid ground? I mean, what if this Francis Ngannou wins, if he knocks out Arlovsky, will you see him fight Stipe? You know, you've got it seems to me that the middleweight division, the 185-pound division, Bisping doesn't want to fight. You know, I mean, he should be fighting the soldier of God who's training every single day. And this soldier of God is just, he's in the gym like he's fighting tomorrow, which is great because he's got a body from God. He's got a work ethic from God. Everything is from God for the soldier of God. And but Bisping, you know, they're really giving him the kid glove treatment there. It's disgusting. It really is. And but you've got people in that division. You've got Jacare. You've got Kelvin. Tim Kennedy just retired. As you know, everybody kind of knew that was going to happen. Weidman. Who knows what's happening to him? He lost two in a row. You've got Massassi. You've got, other fighters, I'm sure, in that division. That's an interesting division, but again, there's nothing set in stone yet. You know, because Bisping wants to take off and, have spent time with his family. I mean, come on. This is absurd. This is ridiculous. Okay? The fans aren't going to tolerate this. All right, you have to apologize. I have a sore throat here. I think one of my roommates is smoking a marijuana cigarette here. I hate to say this, but I'm so used to living the lifestyle of a transient, as I proudly do under the capitalist system. I've gotten used to living with different people. I would say probably in the last year or so, or maybe the last 2 years, I lived with probably over a dozen different people. Okay? It's a way of life. It's a way of life. It's a mere survival in this inhumane, disgusting system. And several of the people that I've lived with have smoked marijuana. I've never smoked it. I've never smoked anything in my life because cigarettes killed both my parents. But it's really, sometimes it gets disgusting, but I'm just so used to it, I can care less. Like, I'm a very, very open-minded person. I'm actually a very libertarian person when it comes to personal behavior. And as long as somebody's not breaking down my doorway and trying to tell me how to do what to do and this and that, I don't give a shit what you do in your room. Or, do whatever you do. Okay, pal? Totally not related to MMA or anything. You know, we go back and forth here on Carson's Corner. As I said, this is an extemporaneous show, and if that offends you, then screw you. I could care less. Okay, we do things by how we want to do it. Nobody tells me what to do. Nobody tell Razor Ramon what to do. There was actually three shootings. There's been several shootings around where I work and around where I've been. And I don't pretend to say that this has any type of meaning or anything like that. But there was a shooting last Friday right next to where I work. Two people were shot. There was a drive-by shooting on Monday. And this is all within a couple miles of where I work. You know, when the shooting on Friday was probably, I was probably maybe a thousand feet from it. Okay, this was at the La Quinta Hotel, which I've stayed at a couple times. It's really a disaster. I don't want to say disaster. It's not that bad, but I mean, it's declining. A buddy of mine says that they used to rent the rooms out to Monmouth University students, and now, it's just the riffraff, whatever. You get the picture. There's a drive-by shooting on Monday. 2 weeks before this, there was a shooting in a pharmacy where some junkie tried to rob a pharmacy, some Eatontown man, and the cops shot him in the leg, and this guy goes and gets treatment in New York, and they find him. And then they arrest him in New York. And all of this is like, I've been to all these places, like all of this is like happening right around me. It's like a war zone. It's just crazy. Now, this latest shooting in the La Quinta on Friday, there's almost no media. Nobody's reporting about this. And these two shooting suspects are in the hospital right down the road from me in protective custody. So I'm thinking to myself, what the hell is going on here? you know. Jesus, like what are we? Was this like a mob thing? Is this a gang? Like, can they reveal some information to the public? I mean, you know, aren't the public isn't the public entitled to know this stuff? I mean, come on. So I don't know what the hell is going on here, folks. I don't know anymore. But I'll keep you updated. Keep updated on my Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Also, follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. Big thanks again to Ricardo Lamas. You can check my political show out here on Monday from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. Going to be doing some new things. Hopefully have some new announcements here in 2017. Keep up to date. Like I said, friend me. Communicate with me. Show some respect, okay? Take care, ladies and gentlemen. And until next time, show some respect.